Welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Speck. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, Kubad Talabani, Kurdistan Regional Government's representative to the United States and the son of the current president of Iraq, speaks on what he calls the other Iraq. Mr. Talabani is the representative of the Kurdistan Regional Government to the United States. Literally meaning the land of the Kurds, Kurdistan is located in the northern part of Iraq, bordering Syria to the west, Iran to the east, and Turkey to the north. The Kurdistan region is an autonomous region in federal Iraq, functioning with its own president, parliament, prime minister, and even some of its own laws. Mr. Talabani answers to the prime minister of Kurdistan and works closely with the U.S. government, the media, and research institutions, providing critical analysis and up-to-date information about the situation in Iraq and the Kurdistan region. Mr. Talabani's family has been involved in Kurdish politics for decades. In 1975, his father founded the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, known as the PUK, one of the two large political parties, the other being the Kurdistan Democratic Party, or the KDP. In the aftermath of Operation Iraqi Freedom in the spring of 2003, Kubad Talabani served as a senior foreign relations officer for the PUK. In that position, he worked closely with the U.S.-led Coalition Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, and he was the PUK's top liaison to the coalition after it became the Coalition Provisional Authority, or the CPA. Mr. Talabani was also a key PUK negotiator during the drafting of the Transitional Administrative Law, Iraq's first post-Saddam constitution. Mr. Talabani's father, Jalal Talabani, is the president of the Republic of Iraq today. He was elected in 2005 and is the first Kurd to hold the position as president of Iraq. After visiting Nome, Alaska and West High School in Anchorage, on Friday, November 14th, Kubad Talabani spoke on the other Iraq at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents the representative of the Kurdistan Regional Government to the United States and the son of Iraq's president, Kubad Talabani.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you to the Alaska World Affairs Council. To Lisa, who took good care of me here in Anchorage, and also to Dr. Cox, who took such good care of me in Nome, kept me safe from the grizzly bears, and I enjoyed roughing it in his pickup truck. I felt very much like as if I was in Kurdistan. Actually, I feel very much at home here, and it is a real privilege to be in Alaska. I'm surrounded by good people, had good food. I'm surrounded by beautiful mountains and very cold winters. And for those of you that know a thing or two about Kurdistan, you'll see that we have all of these things that you have here. We, like you, are part of a nation that has unique and diverse identities. We in Kurdistan, like you in Alaska, look very warily upon the central government in your country. We have the same feelings. We live in interesting neighborhoods, just like you do. We have some interesting neighbors as well. And oil is also both important for you in Alaska as it is for us in Kurdistan. And it's the potential to be the backbone of our economy, the backbone of our development. But for us, oil, until very recently, has been a curse to our people. For when oil was found in Kurdistan, successive Iraqi governments worked against the Kurds, forced mass displacement of Kurds from their towns and villages, and replaced those Kurds with Arabs from the center and south of the country. A tragedy and a genocide whose remnants are visible today and make up much of the tension that exists in the country today. Like Alaska, we have beautiful mountains. The mountains, for us, for many years, were our only friends. There is an old Kurdish saying that we have no friends but the mountains. I'm proud to say that we have friends far away from the mountains of Kurdistan, close to the mountains of Alaska, and I do feel that I am among friends today. Tourism is a great, an emerging industry for us. And yes, you heard that right. Tourism and not terrorism. People don't associate tourism with Iraq, and that's why we call Kurdistan the other Iraq. It is the Iraq that you don't hear about in the TV stations. It's the Iraq that you don't read about in the newspapers. It's the Iraq that doesn't get reported. Kurdistan is a success story, and it's a success story because of the United States and its intervention, not just in Operation Iraqi Freedom, not just in 2003, but way back in the 90s when the no-fly zones were established, where the U.S., the U.K., France, with the assistance of Turkey, provided the cover to protect the Kurdistan region from Saddam's regime, forcing out the Iraqi administration from the Kurdistan region, giving us, the Kurds, an opportunity for the first time in our existence to administer our own region, to build our own institutions of government, to go through the experiments of practicing democracy, to go through the failures of being politically immature. And we had many failures in the 90s. We had many difficulties. Unfortunately, after the first democratically held elections in the Kurdistan region in 92, infighting broke out between the Kurdish political movements, resulting in the deaths of several thousand innocent Kurds. A dark spot on our history, but a lesson that we've learned from. And it's that history that has made us resolute, that has made us put aside our different ideologies and different beliefs to seek a unified Kurdish front in today's modern Iraq. And it was the unity of the Kurdish movement that was so instrumental to the coalition forces in the removing of Saddam's regime. We are proud to say that Kurds were the only indigenous force that fought alongside the coalition forces in the liberation of Iraq. We suffered the second largest number of casualties to the Americans in the War of Liberation. And we're proud to have fought in that war. We're proud to have taken part in the liberation of our country. And we're proud today to still stand and fight alongside the United States in the war against terrorism, rooting out Al-Qaeda and other extreme elements from our region. Obviously, to understand how successful the Kurdistan region is today, you have to contrast it to where it was in the past. Kurdistan has not always been this success story. It has suffered the worst kinds of atrocities at the hands of successive Iraqi regimes, most recently at the hands of Saddam Hussein's regime. In the late 80s, the government of Iraq embarked on the Anfal campaign. The Anfal campaign was a campaign named after a chapter in the Quran, meaning the spoils of war. During this campaign, which lasted from 87 through to the spring and summer of 88, 4,500 villages were totally destroyed in the Kurdistan region. 200,000 men, women, and children were killed. Chemical and biological weapons were used in over 250 instances. Millions of people were displaced from their homes. Livestock was killed. Trees were cut down, wells were blocked up, and there was an intent by this regime to scorch our earth, to destroy our society, to eradicate our history and our heritage. But we persevered. Our strength, our resilience, our tenacity, and ultimately, with the assistance of the United States, we were able to have this no-fly zone, to build up our institutions of government, to learn the lessons of democracy, to build on our tragic history, and to take Kurdistan to where it is today, a thriving civil society in the heart of the Islamic Middle East. This is something that America should be proud of. It's your involvement. It's an American foreign policy success story in the Middle East today. Proud to say that Kurdistan is a region that welcomes the United States. It welcomes America's involvement. It welcomes the U.S. troops in our region. It welcomes U.S. business in our region. And we are hopeful that in the future, not only will you send your sons and daughters to serve in a military capacity in our region, but you'll send your companies, your tourists, your educators, your healthcare practitioners, and great institutions like the World Affairs Councils are welcome always to come to Kurdistan and engage in dialogue with the people of Kurdistan. While we are proud of our ethnic identity, we're proud of our Kurdish identity, we're proud of our struggle and our history. We're also proud of the role that we play today in building the new Iraq. We are at the forefront of creating a new Iraq based on new principles, based on new outlooks. We are rid of the old ways of doing things, of strong centralized governments, of dictatorships ruling the country with an iron fist. That Iraq is gone. That Iraq is finished. It's been put to rest with the demise of Saddam Hussein's regime. Today we're building a new Iraq. And this new Iraq has undergone many challenges and will continue to face challenges in the future. We have a constitution in Iraq, a constitution that for the first time the Kurds are upholding above all laws in the country. This constitution defines the country as a federal democracy. It puts in place mechanisms for power to be devolved from the federal government to the regional governments or the provinces or to the municipalities. Seeing this democracy in action is going to take time. Putting in place the mechanisms that will effectively devolve this power, political, economic, and security, is going to take time. There is a lot of mistrust in Iraq, given Iraq's history, given the atrocities that not only the Kurds have faced. Hundreds and thousands of Shiites were buried in mass graves for their role in the uprising in 91. Countless Sunni military officers were executed by Saddam for apparently plotting coups or for not obeying direct orders. So it wasn't just the Kurds that have faced oppression in Iraq. It's been the whole country. And that history has left deep scars and deep wounds within our society. I once heard an Iraqi official say that we don't just need 100,000 U.S. troops after we remove Saddam. We're going to require 100,000 U.S. psychiatrists in Iraq. And it's true, because the country today is scarred. It's mentally scarred. And when we're negotiating on critical issues such as the oil law, a law that's going to manage our natural resources, and the revenue-sharing law that's going to manage the equitable distribution of those revenues, when everybody's distrustful of one another because of the history, it's going to make for very difficult negotiations. It's going to make for challenges in overcoming that mistrust. And here the United States can play an important role in fostering the dialogue, in brokering the dialogue, not imposing the dialogue, not imposing its will or telling us what we should do, but just helping create an environment where we can overcome our differences with our colleagues and friends and the rest of the country. So the natural resources, obviously, for Iraq is the main source of its economy, and it's imperative that we overcome our differences and create a national oil and gas framework that allows us to develop our infrastructure, allows us to export our natural resources in a way that provides maximum returns to the citizens of Iraq. Obviously, we know how unpopular this war has been in the United States. We hear the calls to have your troops return from service in Iraq. And we want your troops to return home as well. We see how beautiful your country is, and we don't want your troops to stay in our country longer than they need to. But you started an operation with us to build a new country from the bottom up, from the ashes of tyranny, and we're not completed in that mission yet. We have made significant progress. The security situation in Iraq is much better today than it was a few years ago. The politics is a lot better than it was several years ago. There is gradually a growing understanding of where everybody's positions are, of what the outstanding challenges are. And I keep pointing people back to the success story of Kurdistan, the other Iraq, the successful part of the country. And if we were able to overcome our differences, which were monumental, I'm positive that the rest of the country can overcome their differences. We can serve as a model to the rest of the country, but we can only be this successful model with the continued engagement and support of the United States. Now, that support need not only be military. It has to be diplomatic. It has to be through you sending your experts, your private sector, your academic institutions. There will undoubtedly be a role for the U.S. military in the future, not only in building up the Iraqi security forces, but also in fighting terrorism, in rooting out the extreme elements, in helping foster dialogue at a local and also national level. And we welcome those troops, which is why the Kurdish groups in Iraq today have been at the forefront of trying to pass this status of forces agreement, a strategic framework agreement between Iraq and the United States. We're disappointed that the talks stalled in the way that they have. We're disappointed that we have not been able to reach this agreement sooner than we have. But we have assured the current leadership in the United States and the future leadership in the United States that the Kurds will continue to play a positive role to ensure that we have a lasting relationship with the United States, a strategic relationship with the United States. You didn't sacrifice all that you sacrificed in your lives, in your finances, in your reputation for Iraq to fail as a project. We will not let that happen. I'm proud to say that Kurdistan is always a beacon of hope for the future of Iraq. Again, we're proud of our heritage, we're proud of what we've done, we're proud of the advancements that we've made in the north, but we will continue to work to build a new Iraq. We will not accept an Iraq that returns to some sort of dictatorship, and the US should not accept that. Again, you didn't sacrifice all of this for Iraq to fail or for another dictatorship to emerge under a new guise. Which is, again, why we continue to call upon prolonged dialogue, engagement of various different levels to address the key outstanding issues that we face today in Iraq. I am optimistic, having overcome the challenges that we've overcome, that the rest of the country can do the same. I am optimistic that America's resolve will show through, that the incoming administration will not make any rash decisions, that it'll make a thoughtful decision on its future Iraq policy. We're warm to hear of the President-elect Obama talk about a responsible and phased withdrawal from Iraq. This reassures Iraqis that America is not going to abandon Iraq. It reassures Kurds, after coming so far in such a short period of time, that we're not going to be abandoned again as we were in the 70s and early 90s. And with that, I will end my talk by thanking you as Americans for your patience, by thanking America for its sacrifice in the liberation of our country, and by thanking you for your continued service to promote democracy, to help countries like mine, to help people like mine rise from the ashes of tyranny. It is a pleasure to be in Alaska, and I look forward to answering any questions that you have for me. Thank you.
You've been listening to Kubad Talabani, Kurdistan Regional Government's representative to the United States and the son of the President of Iraq, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on November 14, 2008. Following his talk on The Other Iraq, he responded to questions from the audience. First, he was asked, "Have you spoken to anyone or are you going to speak with anyone in the administration about Alaska's permanent fund, how it works, and how it could be used to help Iraq?"
We've studied it quite well. We're not experts at it yet, but we have certainly studied the Alaska model. In the Kurdistan region, we have passed our own oil law that has given us the legal mandate to develop the natural resources that exist in the Kurdistan region. And I'm proud to say that in our oil law, in the region's oil law, we have dedicated to give back 10% of the proceeds from the sale of oil back to the citizens of the Kurdistan region. It was controversial at the time because it was something that Baghdad was not interested in doing. But we feel that it's something that's necessary because it's important for our people to actually benefit from the natural resources of their country. These resources have been a curse for our people. We've never benefited from these vast resources, and now is an opportunity for us to do so. So we've certainly looked at the Alaska model and the permanent fund.
What is the Kurdistan government's position on whether Iraq should be operating as one federal government or three? Another audience member asked.
It's a very good question. Thank you for asking it. We have long stood for Iraq to be a federal country. We pushed for this in 92 in the Iraqi opposition conferences. We pushed for this all the way in our dialogues with the U.S. governments, successive U.S. governments, as we were part of the Iraqi opposition. We pushed for this in the first post-Saddam constitution, the transitional administrative law, and now I'm proud to say that it has become a key element of the permanent constitution of Iraq, a constitution that was voted on by almost 11 million people. When we talk about federalism, we talk about the principle of devolving political, economic, and security power from the central government to the regions. Now, Iraq today has basically two regions, the Kurdistan region and the rest of the country. The rest of the country is broken up into provinces, with the governor, the provincial council, and municipal councils. There is a law that has been passed by the parliament of Iraq that allows for provinces to form into regions like we are in the Kurdistan region. In Kurdistan, as Dr. Cox mentioned in his introduction, we have the regional government of Kurdistan. We have the National Assembly of Kurdistan. We have local security forces that report to a disciplined chain of command. And we have our own development strategies and municipal policies. So we mustn't equate federalism with partition. I know some have, when Senator Biden rolled out his idea for Iraq, it was touted as partition, it was touted as breaking up the country into various countries. That's not, certainly not what Senator Biden laid out, and he doesn't need me to stick up for him. But the concept of federalism is the only system of government that can work in Iraq today. Because of Iraq's diverse makeup, because of its ethnic and sectarian makeup, because of the mistrust that exists between the various communities, the only way you can rule this country is through an iron fist and a dictatorship, which is unacceptable to people today, or through a federation where you're devolving power to the local governments. Now, whether it's 3 federal regions, whether it's 5 federal regions, whether it's 15 federal regions, that's not for me to say, that's not for anyone else to say, it's not for a US official to say. It's for the people on the ground to say. What's important for us is the principle. What's important for us is the constitution that we drafted, that we ratified, that we worked so tirelessly on, which is far from perfect, but it is what we have. It is the law of the land. It is the law that we uphold above all other laws. Calls for a federal country, allows for regions to be created, and it's ultimately up to the people of the south of the country if they want to turn the 9 southern provinces into one region, or whether they want to have 2 or 3 regions in the south. That's their call, it's not mine. But what's also important, what is my call, is that never again will my people allow to be ruled, to have a policy imposed on them by a federal government that may not know or care for what the needs of those local regions are. And that for us is the key, not the number of the federal regions, but the principle of federalism, the principle of devolving power. And we're seeing this unfold in many different ways. Kurdistan is, nobody's arguing about the Kurdistan region, nobody's trying to take away powers that Kurdistan has today. It is a federal region, it's operating by law as the constitution, but we've now seen in the west and center of the country, the Sons of Iraq, the Awakening Councils that have emerged, neighborhood councils that have taken up arms to fight against the extreme forces and against the terrorists, against Al-Qaeda. This is a form of federalism. This is local security. This is not Baghdad imposing a certain way. This is not Baghdad sending troops into an area to eradicate forces. This is people at a local level taking up arms in a coordinated fashion, side by side with the US, to keep their neighborhoods clean. Now what's important is to institutionalize this. And again, the way we do this is by implementing the constitution of the country, which calls for a federal system.
As a young democracy, what type of environmental ethic do you see developing in Iraq as it begins to build up natural resources and expand the economy?
Environmental protection is something new to us. We've spent the last 80 years protecting ourselves, but now that we feel secure in ourselves and in our government, and now as we're starting to really build industries and build real factories and major sector development, we have to pay close attention to the impact of that increased level of development. Kurdistan today is beautiful because it's clean. It's beautiful today because you can see the mountains and there is no pollution. It's beautiful because at night you can see the stars, and we want to keep it that way. So we're trying to put in place good practices. As we develop our oil and gas sector, we're trying to keep up with international standards of environmental protection. We're trying to bring in international groups to come in and monitor our activity and give us advice on what are good practices. It is not an area that we're experts at by any means, but it's certainly an area that we are paying close attention to. and we have an equivalent for the we have a ministry for environmental affairs who's always complaining that our budget is the lowest in the cabinet, and it is, unfortunately, and they're constantly trying to get more money for this, but it all relates back to having a better understanding of what certain priorities are. And while we're proud to be developing the infrastructure that we are, we wouldn't want to develop it at a cost to our beautiful scenery and our clean air.
In reference to Mr. Talabani's previous statements on political organization in Iraq, another audience member asked him, "What power do you think should be retained by the central government?" He also asked Mr. Talabani to speak about taxation and the court system in Iraq.
The constitution is quite clear. There are three kinds of power outlined in the constitution. Powers that are exclusive to the federal government, powers that are exclusive to the regional governments, and powers that are shared responsibilities between federal and regional governments. The federal government has jurisdiction today in formulating foreign policy, formulating national defense policy, signing international treaties, things such as customs, border police, stamps, logos. These kinds of things are powers that are exclusive to the federal government. Now, the key word here is formulating. It's not necessarily the execution of these policies, but it's the formulation of these national policies. All other policies, except for the management of natural resources, which includes water, are shared. I mean, those management of natural resources and water are shared responsibilities between the federal government and the regional governments, i.e. the oil-producing regions or the regions where there is water or these natural resources. And then there's a paragraph in the Constitution that says anything that is not explicitly stated as powers falling under the exclusive competencies of the federal government automatically rest with the regions. So that's, it's made it easier. Rather than defining which powers are for the regions, you specify which powers are for the federal government. Specify which powers are shared powers, and then all other powers are powers to the region. There's also another powerful article in the Constitution, and that is, in the case of dispute between federal law and regional law trumps federal law. I know you'd like that. But obviously the implementation of this is not as easy as agreeing to write it on paper. Taxation is a local responsibility. There is a judicial court system. There are obviously federal courts and local courts. And again, given the fact that local laws trump federal laws, the courts will use local laws to govern themselves. Last year, we separated the judiciary from the government. We now in Kurdistan have an independent judiciary. It still has a long way to go to become a competent and truly independent judiciary, but we're working to that end, and we're seeking the advice of the American Bar Association and others to try to build the capacity of our judges and our prosecutors. And we just passed in the Kurdistan region a press law that has decriminalized libel. So journalists that criticize leaders and government officials will not be put in prison for such criticism, but will receive hefty fines if they're found guilty.
In his speech, Mr. Talabani mentioned the U.S. troops currently assisting in building up Iraqi troops. An audience member wanted to know, how is that going so far?
I think it's been a major challenge to build up a national army. It's been a very difficult undertaking, and it's also been even more difficult to build up a national police. I think part of the challenge has become, in the early days, when the police force was created, we just accepted everybody. The Coalition Provisional Authority, Ambassador Bremer and company, they just had anybody that wanted to join the police could join the police. There was no vetting put in place. And that caused lots of problems. And we saw in the city of Mosul, which is a very important, critical city in the north of the country, overnight, 90% of the police stations in Mosul turned from being the police force of the region to become an insurgency force because they were not vetted. There were people that were not true to the new system of governance, were still loyal to the old regime or had strong anti-American and anti-Iraqi sentiments. With the army, it's been a little better. It's the creation of the Iraqi army has been more in a disciplined and incremental fashion. There's been more U.S. Mentoring in the creation of the new Iraqi army. The process has been a lot slower. And we've, obviously as Kurds, we're in no rush to see Iraq have another million-man army anytime soon. We think that Iraq can spend its money elsewhere. I think that law enforcement is what's required today to secure Iraq, and law enforcement, the best law enforcement is local law enforcement, because it's the local people that know the streets, it's the local people that know their neighborhoods. We have now countless Iraqi army divisions, some more competent than the others, but it has still been difficult to get a sense of a national army. There are divisions that are predominantly Kurdish, there are divisions that are predominantly Arab, there are some divisions that are predominantly Shiite, there are some divisions that are predominantly Sunni. With these awakening councils now, we're not sure how they're going to fit into the national framework. Will they become part of the police force? Will they stay on as paramilitary units? Will they dissipate? It's difficult to see. It would be a shame to see these forces dissipate because they have been instrumental. We advocate them being incorporated into some sort of structure, some sort of federal structure. But it is one of the challenges that remains today that the U.S. needs to continue to engage on. It's not just about the quantity of the personnel, but it's more about the quality of the personnel and the quality of the leadership of those battalions and those brigades and those divisions. And that can only, you know, there's the best experience for that is the battleground, and there's plenty of battles being fought today. So there's a lot of good experienced officers now. And again, the Kurds have not held back in supporting the new Iraqi army. We were the first to send our troops. We sent three battalions as part of the surge plan, as part of the Baghdad security plan. The conflict that took place in Basra had two Kurdish special forces battalions there. So it's not just about protecting and preserving the Kurdistan region, but it's also about portraying a positive role in other parts of the country to defend all of Iraq.
If regional law trumps federal law, how is there any uniform rule of law? Another audience member asked.
I don't think that there rule of law is rule of law. I mean, you don't need a uniform rule of law. You need to have a law that's applicable to that region or to that area, depending on the wishes of the people in that region or that area. When we were drafting the first post-Saddam constitution, there was a lot of controversy over two distinct articles of the Constitution. One that said no law or article in this Constitution must contradict the tenets of Islam. Another one said no rule or law or article of this Constitution should contradict the principles of democracy. Now, you could argue for years on what trumps what can you have the two coexist. Somebody with strong religious convictions could say that the ladies must have their hair covered at all times. A secular Democrat could say, well, this could be infringing on somebody's individual freedoms and infringes on the principles of democracy. So here, by having federalism here can resolve these kinds of issues. In Kurdistan, where it's the society there is predominantly tolerant, it's predominantly secular, people can choose whether they want to have their hair covered, whether they want to abide by a strict code of Islam, whether they choose to drink alcohol or not. Whereas in the south of the country, if people want to behave and live in a more religious climate and have a stricter adherence to Islam, then they can do so. But what we're trying to avoid is somebody in Najaf, which is a religious city, a holy city, a revered city in Iraq, telling somebody in Sleymaniyah, where we are from, how to live their lives and how to conduct their lives. And by having this federal structure in place, we're putting in place checks and balances to prevent another dictatorship from emerging under any sort of guise. There obviously will be uniform laws across the country, but the laws have to represent the characteristics of this country. And Iraq being so ethnically diverse, so sectarian in nature, in the different sects and religious groups and ethnic groups that exist. You cannot have a blanket policy or a blanket law that can apply to all of these people, given Iraq's miserable history up until 2003.
Can you please comment on current relations with Turkey?
The Kurdistan region's relationship with Turkey has been rocky over the last 10 years, but I'm proud to say that over the last 8 months, things have improved significantly. Up until Operation Iraqi Freedom, there was a good dialogue with Turkey. And Kurdish leaders were going to Turkey all the time. Turkish leaders were coming through the Kurdistan region. But after the liberation of Iraq and the stronger emergence of a Kurdish identity and the Kurdish regional government and the institutions in Kurdistan, the relations were strained. They were further strained, obviously, by the tensions between the American and Turkish relations that also played an impact, and Turkey's long-standing problem with the PKK. But I'm proud to say since May of this year, the Kurds have been in direct talks with representatives of the Turkish government, the first such talks since the Operation Iraqi Freedom. And these talks have led to a much improved atmosphere, to a reduced rhetoric, to a reduced level of violence, it's allowed us to create a way where Kurds and government, Turkish government officials can seek solutions that will create peace and stability on our border. We're hopeful that these talks will continue and this improved climate will continue. Something that not many Americans are aware of is that we hear a lot about tensions between Turks and Kurds. But in our development, in our vast economic development over the last 4 or 5 years, we've had billions of dollars, foreign money invested in the infrastructure in Kurdistan. 75% of that foreign investment has come from Turkey. I wish I could say that 70% of it came from the United States, but only 1% of it comes from the United States. The rest is from Iran, from Russia, China, Korea, some European countries. So while, again, we're proud that you've had such a strong engagement in Iraq, we're hoping that your private sector can get more involved in our development and get involved in our investment, because that leaves behind a lasting legacy and a lasting friendship. But that private sector engagement by Turkey in the Kurdistan region is also very significant in building political bridges, in building bridges for the future, and allowing us to have discussions on a broad range of topics rather than just one or two security-related projects.
What is the Kurdistan government's position on Kurds in neighboring countries, like Turkey, for example? Another audience member asked.
We certainly do not want to interfere in the internal affairs of any of our neighbors. We do live in a very tricky neighborhood. and we have to be careful what we say and what we do and what we offer and what we don't. But obviously there is a kinship among Kurds in Turkey and Syria and Iran, Iraq, former Soviet Republic, and in new Kurdish republics in Sweden and in Germany. we only have a handful of about 50,000 Kurds in the United States, so we're not encroaching on American territory just yet. Although the largest contingent is in Nashville, Tennessee, with about 8,000 Kurds in Nashville. I think it must be the moonshine there that is on. but obviously Kurds in Turkey look with pride to what's going on in Iraqi Kurdistan. Kurds in Iran look with pride to what's going on in Iraqi Kurdistan. There are students from Turkish city, Kurds in Turkey and Kurds of Iran, that study in the universities in Iraqi Kurdistan. There's a lot of cultural exchanges, sports exchanges, businessmen and women coming in, musical teams and all kinds of activities that are going on. But we have to respect the sovereignty of our neighboring countries, just like how we don't want or expect them to interfere in our affairs. We certainly won't interfere in their affairs, and it's something that obviously we want to play a constructive role, and if that means not playing a role, that means taking a step back.
Another audience member mentioned the transfer of power from father to son, which has traditionally occurred in many countries neighboring Iraq. He asked Mr. Talabani, as Iraq emerges as a democracy, does it give you pause to consider the message that will be sent to the rest of the world?
I assure everyone in this room and in the United States, I will never run for office in the presidency of Iraq. Just to break this trend. But obviously, if this experiment in Iraq succeeds, if Iraq can become a plural, multi-ethnic, multi-sectarian, relative democracy, we have to be realistic. It's never going to be Switzerland. May not, you know, but it's going to be relative. Whatever happens in Iraq is going to be relative to its history, to its surroundings, to its capabilities, and to its understanding. But of course, if Iraq becomes this strong, Western-looking, modern, forward-thinking government that is able to execute and develop its natural resources, then not only does it become a political powerhouse, but it becomes an economic powerhouse. And if Kurds, Turks, Turkmens, Arabs, Shiites, Sunnis, Christians, Yazidis, Shabaks, Mandians, Sabians, all these different groups that live in Iraq today can live in a degree of decency, tolerance, peace, acceptance of one another's views, then of course this sends a message. Even if it's subliminal, it'll send a message across the borders. All of these countries in the Middle East are multi-ethnic, are multi-sectarian. It is wrong to call it the Arab Middle East. It is wrong to call it the Islamic Middle East. There are a multitude of ethnicities, of traditions, of different sectarian groups that exist in these regions. And if people can just live in tolerance and can accept one another for who they are, then I think that this obviously serves as a great model. And we're starting to sow the seeds of this model in Kurdistan. We have tens of thousands of Christians living in Kurdistan. Unfortunately, because of the violence in the rest of the country, we've seen another 20,000 Christian families flee their homes in Basra, in Baghdad, in Nineveh, move to the Kurdistan region where they've been welcomed with open arms. Kurdistan has a long history of having Jewish Kurds, many of whom have fled the country, but who would one day want to come back to where they grew up or where their fathers grew up. Again, there's a great acceptance of people wishing to live a religious lifestyle or a secular lifestyle in Kurdistan. If we can overcome the mentality of our region, the intolerance that existed in our region, and create a diverse and tolerant society in Kurdistan, the rest of the country can do so. And if the rest of the country can do so, and this model that America has been so heavily involved in succeeds, of course it's going to send a strong message elsewhere, and that's exactly what we're trying to do.
Would it be advisable to further break up Iraq? Another audience member asked.
Sure. Well, we don't necessarily like the word breakup. Breakup seems to have a bad connotation, you know, partition. You think of India, you think of the former Yugoslavia. I just think that, you know, this is not the partition states of America. This is the United States of America. And federalism throughout history has been created as a system of governance to unite countries, not to divide countries. And this is part educational on our part to educate our fellow Iraqis to explain to them that federalism is not a dividing factor, but more a uniting factor. Before Operation Iraqi Freedom, we had no ties to the central government. We had no interactions with the central government. We had nothing to bind us and the central government together. But federalism has actually reintegrated Kurdistan into the rest of the country. And this is something now that Sunni Arabs are starting to realize is potentially their only protection against a Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad. I can't touch on the number of regions and what is most effective and what isn't, because, again, it's really not my call. It's for the people in those regions to determine whether they trust a federal government, whether they want to be ruled by that federal government, or they want to be ruled by their own regional government or a neighboring government. And this is ultimately what the Constitution has outlined this process, the law for federalism has outlined this process. There is a complicated issue in Iraq, and that's the issue of disputed territories. There are several disputed territories in Iraq, multi-ethnic, and I touched on it earlier in terms of the ethnic cleansing that took place in most of those areas. Kirkuk, who a friend in the front row will soon come to fully understand, is one of the most complex situations in Iraq. Kirkuk is an oil-rich city in Iraq. The Talibanis originally are from a southern area of Kirkuk. But when oil was discovered in Kirkuk, there was forced migration of Kurds and Turkmens from these towns and cities, replaced by Arabs from the center and south of the country. It's created much tension, displacement of hundreds and thousands of people. And this displacement has built up resentment. Built up resentment between Kurds and Arabs, because now Kurds want to come back into their homes. Arabs don't want to leave their homes. Some Arabs were actually bought into these homes against their will by Saddam. So they're as much victims of this ethnic cleansing policy as the Kurds who were forced to leave are. And that's why there's an article in the Constitution that calls for resolving these disputed territories. It's called Article 140 of the Constitution. And that's put in place a framework where there's a resettlement process where people are compensated if they have to leave, and others are compensated to come in. And then ultimately a referendum will be held to determine who administers those disputed territories, whether they'll be administered from Baghdad, whether they'll be administered from the north, or whether they'll be their own federal regions. And this kind of system will have to be applied elsewhere in the country, in other parts that may want to be ruled by themselves as a region or by the federal government. It has to include participation of the public. This is not a policy that can be imposed either from the federal government or from the regional government, but it has to be something that involves grassroots and local councils, provincial councils, and regional governments. And it's very complex. It's a new thinking. It's a new way of doing things in Iraq. Iraqis are so used to looking up and just being spoon-fed from the federal government, be employed by the federal government, have oil and food delivered by the federal government, that it created a sense that there was no ownership. There was no ownership of the factories that they worked in. There was no ownership over the jobs that they were working in. Now, putting the onus back on the citizens is giving them a sense of ownership, just like how the security services now in these different areas are feeling proud to be securing their own towns and cities because they're doing it for themselves. They're not doing it for the prime minister or the president in Iraq. They're doing it for their own communities. Once people have ownership over their own lands, they take pride in it. They take pride in the development of their own towns and cities. And local leaders are then held more accountable. If they're successful, they bring money to the state. If they build development to the state, it makes them accountable. And it's going to be fascinating to see it play out. And we're not sure whether it'll be 2, 5, 3, or 15 regions. But what we can be certain of is that it'll never once again be ruled by a strong government, because we don't want to emulate some of our neighboring countries and some of the other countries in the Middle East. We want to be the example, and we've proven in Kurdistan that we can lead the way, and we'll continue to lead the way.
Next, a United States military officer who will soon be on the ground in Iraq asked, "If I were running for mayor of Kirkuk, what platform would I run on? What is the best way forward for U.S. military in Iraq?"
You do pretty well. I'm sure you'd do well in running for mayor of Kirkuk. I think obviously there's going to be a strong need for counterterrorism in Kirkuk. And we've seen over the years how terrorists have tried to stoke ethnic violence in Kirkuk. Terrorists from Al-Qaeda have killed Kurds and Turkmens, and then suddenly the Kurds think that the Turkmens killed the Kurds, Turkmens think that the Kurds killed the Turkmens, and there's suddenly a fight breaks out between the groups. Thankfully, since Operation Iraqi Freedom, Kirkuk has never exploded. Mosul has exploded on several occasions and is able to be put back together again. Kirkuk is not like any other city in Iraq. Because of its history, because of its resources, because of the emotions attached to Kirkuk, if, heaven forbid, we collectively lose Kirkuk and Kirkuk implodes, it'll be very difficult to put Kirkuk and Iraq back together again. So,
No pressure,
Colonel. No pressure. But I think in working with locals is the way forward. In promoting economic development is the way forward. Once people have services, electricity, water, food, there's an education system, there's healthcare system, then you've taken away the ammunition for the insurgents. You've taken away the tools that the terrorists use to turn people against you and against us. By working with local security services, you'll be able to quickly find who the bad elements are and who the good elements are. And it's complicated because you're going to have four different groups telling you four different things, but I'm sure you'll be smart enough to find out who's telling you the truth and who isn't. And you know, you'll find the Kurds to be a very honest player in this game.
Another audience member wanted to know what to expect as a tourist in Iraq. She also asked Mr. Talabani if he had been schooled in the United States.
I'm a loyal subject of Her Majesty. I'm a British citizen. The Brits are Americans and Kurds, our former masters. And they had a big role in creating the Iraq that we had until 2003. So I wasn't schooled in the US, I was schooled in the UK. Like all Kurds, I study engineering and we end up in politics. It's a very strange, but apparently a natural transition. We have so many engineers in Kurdistan, it's amazing. But as far as tourism goes, I think the first thing you'll see is an airline that'll fly you into Kurdistan from all the way from Washington, D.C. via Vienna, Austrian Airlines. Into Erbil, it flies four or five times a week. It is a Star Alliance member, so you can fly on your United Miles points. And we're proud to have Austrian Airlines as a partner that flies into Kurdistan. We're hoping that one day an American airline will fly into the Kurdistan region. We need the State Department's assistance on this front because currently the State Department still has a travel warning for Iraq, saying that the whole country is in flames and it's dangerous, and it's amazing that on one hand you know we're promoting certain things and the U.S. own government is sometimes working against itself. But that shouldn't be a surprise to any of you here, should it? But certainly we have you, once you arrive at the airport, you'll see professional customs and immigration officers. You'll be whisked away in a taxi to a hotel of your choice. We claim that they're five-star hotels, but they're really not. I'm going to be honest with you. They're probably about a three-star hotel. We have two genuine five-star hotels being constructed in the city of Erbil. One in Soleimania, the one in Erbil, is a Kempinski hotel, and it'll be a genuine five-star hotel. The first thing you'll see is a boom in construction, housing villages everywhere, and they have great names. We have the British Village. We have the American Village. We have the German Village. You can see where this is going. I don't know why we're calling them villages, but it's very nice gated communities that are being constructed. Prices go anywhere from $150,000 to over $500,000 in a pretty cash-based economy. That is still, it's astounding. We've had houses go for over $1 million in Kurdistan, and it's even I have to pinch myself saying, this is Kurdistan, this is not Switzerland. or Alaska. You know? But you'll see a lot of antiquities in Kurdistan. There's a lot of biblical references to Kurdistan in the Bible. Erbil, the capital, is mentioned in the Bible as Arbaela. The citadel of Erbil has 16 generations of different dynasties and from the Assyrian kingdom to the Medes to current day. It is one of the most longest and continually inhabited places on earth. You'll see the beautiful bazaars and souks that are quite prevalent in the Middle East. People selling their own goods, sweets, candy. It's a big thing. Kurdish honey, best honey in the world. Would love to one day walk into a Whole Foods or one of the fanciest supermarkets and see Kurdish honey on display, and I'm pretty sure we'll see that in my lifetime. But you'll be greeted by a very warm and gracious people that appreciate the value and the sacrifice of the United States, and you'll have the beautiful mountains. Hopefully eventually we can go skiing in those mountains safely. We need to clear a few landmines first. I mean, you can have adventure skiing. I know there's probably some adventurous people in this room right now. You get extra points if you detonate a landmine. But the possibilities are really endless, and we're very excited to be building up that sector. We're blessed to not only have oil as a natural resource. We have a national resource, which is our people, which is our scenery, which is our topography, which is our culture and our history. Our agricultural potential is huge. We could grow absolutely anything. We have very good climate. I think we have the potential to make very good wine, if those, you know, will be really controversial in that part of the world once we have Kurdish wine on sale. But we have good potential. We've had actually some vintners come over and look at the possibilities there. So you have a lot to see, and we'd love to have you. Distant Horizons is a tour company that arranges for people wishing to travel to the Kurdistan region. You're welcome to contact us at www.krg.org if anyone's interested in coming to Kurdistan. I guarantee you it's safe, it's secure, it's safer than most parts of D.C. where I live. I'm always looking over my shoulder in D.C. I never look over my shoulder in Kurdistan, and people that go there, especially the servicemen and women of the U.S. Armed Forces and the Air Force, when they're there, they take off their flak jackets. You immediately see them at ease and comfortable. And I remember the days in the late 90s, if one foreigner came to Kurdistan, we'd all know about it. We'd be so excited. We'd be like, there's an American there, there's a French person. Now the airlines are full. You cannot get a seat on the plane. You've got to book weeks in advance. People are coming from all over the world to see this great region, to see this emerging market, to see this success story. And it's a success story that I hope more of you will see, that more Americans will see. And more importantly, the more Americans will feel a part of and feel proud of. And that, for me, is the most important thing. This was done with your sweat, with your toil, with your patience, with your sacrifice, along with our own sacrifice, with our own struggle and our own toil. But it's something that we've done together, and it's something that I hope we can continue to build on as we go through this very difficult time together.
The role of the military is very important to Americans in general, another audience member stated. Can you shed some light on the role of the Peshmerga in Kurdistan and how they provide security in Iraq?
I appreciate that question. The Peshmerga is the Kurdish security force. It translates into those who face death. It is probably Iraq's most organized military force. It's probably its most capable. I'm a little biased, but I can afford to be that biased. It has been involved in protecting Kurdistan for many decades. It, like I said, partnered with the U.S. military in Operation Iraqi Freedom, Operation Viking Hammer in particular. It today serves as a role to continue to protect the Kurdistan region. We have sent a lot of the best and brightest of our Peshmerga forces into the new Iraqi army. So there are many Kurds make up the new Iraqi army. But it's not just the Peshmerga that are instrumental in keeping the Kurdistan region safe. It is also the security services of the Kurdistan region. Our intelligence capabilities is probably the best in the country and heavily relied upon by the United States. But our best security, ultimately, is the citizens of the Kurdistan region. It is the citizens that report on the suspicious activity. It is the citizens that report on suspicious behavior in their neighborhoods or a car that's unrecognizable to them. And one of the experiments that we're hoping to transcend to other parts of the country is this participation of the local citizens in securing their towns and their cities. Because without the active engagement of the citizens, you're not going to protect the towns and cities. If the local residents are even acquiescing, not even supporting, but even if they acquiesce to the insurgents and the terrorists, then the terrorists have won. And I think this is what we've seen in many parts of Iraq right now, is people just taking it upon themselves to side with themselves with the U.S., root out the terrorist elements, root out the extreme elements, and protect their own towns and cities. And that, for us, has been something that we've been most proud of. While the citizens, you know, Kurdistan is great and we're proud of it, it certainly has its problems, has its bad governance issues sometimes, it has its corruption issues that we're trying to deal with and root out. It is by no means a model, an effective and efficient government. But while we're working on these issues, citizens are free to criticize us, and they do so regularly, and there are tons of demonstrations against us. But when it comes to their security, that's when they put aside their differences with the government. When it comes to their well-being and the protection of their home, their family, their neighborhoods, or their town, that's when they will call the security services, who they may have criticized the day before. But they'll call them, they'll tell them that this is going on, they'll tip off suspicious behavior. And that's how we've been able to keep the Kurdistan region as safe as we have been. That's how we've been able to prevent one U.S. Citizen from being injured, even in a car accident in the Kurdistan region. And it's a statistic that I have to constantly knock on wood for, but it's a statistic that I'm proud that we'll continue to be able to uphold because of our affection, our support, and our dedication to a lasting and fruitful partnership with the United States. And it's been a pleasure to be in Alaska. I'll hope to come back to this beautiful city again. And thank you all for coming and listening.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents with Kubad Talabani, Kurdistan Regional Government Representative to the United States and the son of Jalal Talabani, Iraq's current president. Mr. Talabani responded to questions from the audience following his talk entitled The Other Iraq, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on Friday, November 14, 2008. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show or share your comments with us and other listeners. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.